Chapter 2. In Defense of Fundamentalism. The sword of the Lord shall devour from the one end of the land even to the other end of the land. No flesh shall have peace. Jeremiah chapter 12. I was a fundamentalist before I could walk, though I was at least 4 years old before I could really use the term. We attended church several times a week, and the preachers in those services were generally my dad, my granddad, one of my uncles, or some close family friend. The women in my family never cut their hair and always wore skirts or dresses, never pants or shorts. The children in my family never said gee or golly for fear of using the name of the Lord in vain, even in a disguised form. We never attended movies at the local theater because we didn't want to support the Hollywood cesspool. We made sure never to go dancing because we knew that dancing leads to sex before marriage, and sex without marriage leads to depravity and hell. We never played card games with a deck of regular playing cards, which we understood had been invented by a crazy, evil Spanish prince named Charles, who designed the deck to portray God the Father, who had sex with Mary the Mother, who gave birth to an illegitimate son named Jesus, who was also the Jack of Spades. We children called adult men sir and adult women ma'am. We carried Bibles around to lots of places that normal people wouldn't be seen with them, and we passed out Bible tracts on street corners and put leaflets for Vacation Bible School under the windshield wipers of thousands of cars. A fundamentalist was set apart from the world. We were definitely going to go to heaven when we died, and those with different views on heaven, hell, God and Satan, sin and salvation were definitely going to hell, which was more than a shame because hell involved eternal torment, literal flames, and wailing and gnashing of teeth. Our job was to tell people about Jesus so that they could avoid going to hell. The only way to get saved was to ask Jesus into your heart. Just that one little sentence, spoken sincerely aloud or in your heart, and you were going to be okay forever, headed for heaven. Most Catholics, however, were going to hell because they were counting on the Pope or a confession to a priest or the benevolence of Mary or their own good works to save them, rather than the blood of Jesus. Communists were going to hell because they didn't believe in God at all. Many, but not all, Democrats were going to hell, not because they were Democrats, but because many of them didn't believe the Bible or understand the right way to get saved. Most liberals and modernists were going to hell for the same reasons. Non-white people generally were going to hell simply because they were more likely to live in remote, non-Christian places such as Africa or Asia or South America, where they would not hear about Jesus dying for them on the cross, and so they would be lost. Virtually everybody in Europe was going to hell because there were very few genuine Christians in any European country. And it only stood to reason that almost everybody living behind the Iron Curtain in China, the Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc, or Cuba was going to hell. From my limited and immature child's point of view, heaven was therefore populated almost exclusively by white people who lived in the United States of America, along with the original disciples of Jesus, an uncalculated number of genuine Christians who had lived throughout the ages, and many but not all of those mentioned in Fox's Book of Martyrs, which I first read at the age of 8 when I found it on my parents' bookshelf. I had a front row seat on the division of the world between sheep and goats, and I soaked up thousands of sermons in regular weekly church services, revival meetings, and Bible camps. Although this book concentrates on the Rice side of my family, my dad, Charles Himes, was also a fundamentalist preacher, pastor, and evangelist for over 60 years. When I was a child, he preached in revival meetings, planted and shepherded small churches, and served on the staff of my grandfather's church in Wheaton, Illinois. Later, he served as full-time pastor of a string of small fundamentalist churches in the South and the Midwest. When most of us think about Christian fundamentalism in America, we think about a particular strand of belief that is embodied in Protestant evangelical conservatism. We picture a set of people whom we think of as embodying or representing fundamentalist belief, including people such as James Dobson, Tim LaHaye, and Pat Robertson, or past fundamentalist luminaries such as Jerry Falwell, Bob Jones, and John R. Rice. Not all of these people have used the word fundamentalist to describe themselves, though several of them wore that title proudly. When I was a child, the God I believed in was an old man, wise and powerful. He had complicated eyebrows, big ears, and eyelids that drooped alarmingly. God was very tall, and he sometimes wore reading glasses. He had a deep voice that echoed when he spoke, and he was certain of his opinion on every conceivable topic. God wore a long white robe and sat on a golden throne from which flowed the river of life. He dwelt in a parallel universe far beyond the sky, in the center of a great city with 12 gates and golden streets lined with mansions where lived all the saints of heaven. Perhaps coincidentally, God looked a lot like my granddad. I thought of fundamentalists as a small group of people led by my granddad and composed mainly of our family and people in our Independent Baptist Church and others who subscribed to the Sword of the Lord newspaper. My family then lived in Wheaton, Illinois, the heart of evangelical America, the home of Wheaton College, and a town with more churches per capita than anywhere else in the country. As far as I knew, however, I was the only fundamentalist kid in my school. Most of the other kids attended evangelical or mainline Protestant churches in Wheaton, but they tended to think my family and I had a set of beliefs that were unusual and somewhat weird. For my part, I seriously believed that most of my supposedly Christian classmates were headed for hell. I also assumed that someday I would be a fundamentalist preacher and inherit the mantle of my dad and my famous granddad. I was steeped in the history and language of fundamentalism before I was 10 years old. In sermon after sermon, I heard my granddad preach about the heroes of fundamentalism, such evangelists as Charles Finney, D.L. Moody, R.A. Torrey, and Billy Sunday, and leaders such as William Jennings Bryan. And I heard him wage an ongoing theological war against people the likes of Nels Ferrey, Harry Emerson Fosdick, and Clarence Darrow, whom he called liberals, modernists, and infidels. I did not understand this well. I just assumed that anyone who agreed with Granddad was a good person on the side of God, and anyone he had disparaged was no friend of mine and would likely go to hell. As a child, I was comfortable as a fundamentalist. I was sure I knew everything there was to know about the world that was important. The Bible was the literal word of God. God was a powerful and angry, yet somehow loving Father who lived in a literal and physically real heaven and who sent sinners to hell to spend eternity with a literal and evil guy named Satan. The list of my possible sins was long and specific and reliably elucidated by my granddad, the most authoritative person in the universe. The only way to be a Christian was to get saved. Anyone who was not saved was going straight to hell at the end of life. God hated sin, and Jesus died to save lost sinners. Once I was saved, I would always be saved and could never be lost, no matter what I did or how I failed. All of these were certainties. I am the son of a Baptist preacher and the grandson and great-grandson of Baptist preachers, and the brother of a Baptist missionary to Japan. I am the nephew of 5 Baptist preachers and the great-nephew of 2. I have 23 cousins and uncountable second cousins, many of whom grew up to be preachers or missionaries. I lived in the middle of this big and entertaining family that appeared to harbor no doubts about who we were or what God wanted us to do. I loved them all, and I loved being a part of that extended family. My aunts were all gorgeous, my uncles were all funny and smart, and my cousins and siblings, generally speaking, were sweet, adventurous, decent human beings who were fun to play with. I loved going to church on Sunday mornings, and I loved going over to my grandparents' house after church for a big family dinner every Sunday afternoon, after which we played some non-sinful game such as caroms, Monopoly, Rook, or dominoes. Within my family, everything was easy. It was only when we interacted with others outside our circle that I noticed the complexity of the world. I can identify several specific ways in which my training as a fundamentalist bore good and healthy fruit, though I'm aware that a statement like that may be greeted with some skepticism by those who have only witnessed the world of fundamentalism from the outside. As a fundamentalist, I learned that it was perfectly all right for me to have an idea or outlook different from most folks, and to struggle for what I believed in the face of determined opposition. I learned that it was acceptable to be passionate about my values and to care deeply about the consequences of my actions. I learned to view myself as an imperfect human who needs help from outside myself. I learned that faith and community are essential to life. All of this discussion of fundamentalism begs the question of what fundamentalism is. The reality is that most of us mean quite different things by this heavily loaded word. My own favorite definition was provided by historian George Marsden in his book, Understanding Fundamentalism and Evangelicalism. A fundamentalist is an evangelical who is angry about something. A more precise statement of the same point is that an American fundamentalist is an evangelical who is militant in opposition to liberal theology in the churches or to changes in cultural values or mores, such as those associated with secular humanism. Fundamentalists are not just religious conservatives. They are conservatives who are willing to take a stand and to fight. This is a definition distorted by the public proclamations of certain fundamentalist leaders, of course, and I know many fundamentalists who are not angry people, including most of my relatives, but it is also a definition that makes sense to me. I am no longer consciously a fundamentalist, but my family and closest friends will happily tell you that I have a deeply ingrained, or at least well-trained, propensity to be pugnacious and overly certain of my own opinions, along with more attractive traits such as my love for silly wordplay and my glorious hair. And I spent much of the first part of my life as an angry and arrogant young man, qualities that subsided only after I relaxed by learning how to juggle, unicycle, and run long distances. Now, in my 60s, I've calmed down a bit, but I still exhibit occasional outbreaks of self-righteousness. Ironically, the word fundamentalist has gone out of favor among fundamentalists in the 21st century. Few people want to be called a fundamentalist these days, and some people whose politics and theology are most deeply fundamentalist are precisely the people who do not want to be called fundamentalists anymore. It's easy to confirm this. Just visit the website of any of the principal institutions of the fundamentalist movement in America, such as Bob Jones University or the Sword of the Lord newspaper. Search for the fundamentalist label anywhere on any of these websites. You'll find references to the use of the word fundamentalist from 10, 15, or 100 years in the past, but no contemporary usage. John R. Rice's friend Jerry Falwell was the leading fundamentalist in America in the decades after Granddad's death in 1980, and in 1981, Falwell published a book titled The Fundamentalist Phenomenon, which proclaimed the political and moral triumph of the movement. Today, however, search the website of Liberty Journal, the online publication of Jerry Falwell's Liberty University, and you get the following result. Your search, fundamentalist, did not match any documents. No pages were found containing fundamentalist. Suggestions: make sure all words are spelled correctly. Try different keywords. Try more general keywords. Mark Driscoll is the prominent pastor of Mars Hill Church in a neighborhood near my home in Seattle. I've attended Driscoll's church several times to listen to his preaching and to get a clear sense of his theology, which is identical in almost every respect with older fundamentalists such as John R. Rice, though he adds a twist of Calvinism, his belief that some people are simply doomed to hell and others are elected by God and destined for heaven. Driscoll does not claim to be a fundamentalist, and many who today willingly accept the label of fundamentalist would not claim him as their sectarian brother. Nonetheless, Driscoll is a fundamentalist in everything but name and shares virtually all his doctrinal positions and attitudes with any other fundamentalist. Driscoll is aware that fundamentalists have developed a bad reputation for being judgmental and self-righteous. He therefore claims not to be one. He defines fundamentalists simply as people who do not like smoking, drinking, and cussing, and then he offers a shallow critique of fundamentalism. Fundamentalism is really losing the war, Driscoll said in an interview with Christianity Today. And I think it is in part responsible for the rise of what we know as the more liberal end of the emerging church, because a lot of what is fueling the left end of the emerging church is fatigue with hardcore fundamentalism that throws rocks at culture. But culture is the house that people live in, and it just seems really mean to keep throwing rocks at somebody's house. Driscoll's attempt to avoid the label of fundamentalism by suggesting the movement is only about culture, disapproval of cigars, pop music, and Hollywood picture shows, is the shallowest possible definition of fundamentalism. However, it seems to attract many who are uncomfortable with the cultural straitjacket of fundamentalism, but open to Driscoll's fundamentalist interpretation of God and the Bible. The September 11, 2001 terrorist attack was a significant factor in the modern demise of fundamentalism as a term used by a sizable number of Christians to describe themselves. The story that politicians, newscasters, and commentators repeated a million times over in the years after that tragic September was that terrorists generally were Muslim fundamentalists responsible for assaulting the foundations of the American way of life. Hearing fundamentalism equated with terrorism a few times is enough to make you want to avoid the label of fundamentalism altogether. The basic assumptions and doctrines of fundamentalism, nonetheless, have influenced American history for over two centuries. And fundamentalist politics and religion have dramatically shaped American foreign policy and social policy for decades. Christian fundamentalism in America has its roots in the history of the South after the end of the Civil War. The underlying attitudes and assumptions leading to modern fundamentalism grew and flourished amid the wreckage of the war and Reconstruction, and as a response to the trauma of that war. They were nourished by the end of slavery and by the soil of poverty and defeat. They took root, especially in the deepest South, and particularly in the state of Texas, during the first three decades of the 20th century, as my grandfather was beginning his ministry. For all Christians, fundamentalist, evangelical, mainline Protestant, or Catholic, understanding fundamentalism matters, because Christians are losing the struggle to have any appreciable influence in the thoughts, hearts, and lives of most Americans. The political domination of the religious right over the past three decades in America has had a profoundly negative effect on how Americans think about Christianity. A groundbreaking survey titled "Unchristian: What a New Generation Really Thinks About Christianity" was published in 2007 by the Evangelical Christian Barna Group. Its authors, David Kinneman and Gabe Lyons, report that large majorities of non-church-going Americans are openly hostile to Christians. 87% believe that Christians are too judgmental of others. 86% believe that Christians are hypocritical, saying one thing and doing another. 75% believe that Christians are too involved in politics. Over two-thirds believe that Christians are out of touch with reality, insensitive to others, boring, and not accepting of other faiths. 90% believe that Christians hate homosexuals. Younger Christians especially are likely to see and share these perceptions. As one survey respondent said, Christians have become political, judgmental, intolerant, weak, religious, angry, and without balance. Christianity has become a nice Sunday drive. Where is the living God, the Holy Spirit, an amazing Jesus, the love, the compassion, the holiness? This type of life, how I yearn for that. For many Americans throughout our history, a neighbor was someone who looked like you, perhaps someone who lived next door and went to church with you and did business with you. A neighbor might be someone who was related to you by ties of blood or class or political affiliation. It's easy to feel compassion for that sort of neighbor. It's easy to put yourself in the other person's shoes when that other person shares your economic interests or your notion of God. In general, a fundamentalist outlook made a lot of sense in a world in which you needed to be certain where to stand in order to survive the next day and to defend the lives and welfare of your family. Fundamentalism was a rational and emotional response to a dangerous world where you needed to know who was a sheep and who was a goat, who was for you and who was against you, who might slip a blade between your ribs and who would love you back. Likewise, fundamentalist religion has reflected the absolutism of fundamentalist politics. Historically, Christian fundamentalists in America focused on identifying and proclaiming the set of doctrines, beliefs, that have been held by Orthodox Christians since about the 4th century. Fundamentalists then militantly defended those doctrines against perceived heretical threats from liberals and modernists in the early 20th century. But what happens to fundamentalism when its original enemies have been defeated or have disappeared, and the debate of a century ago becomes irrelevant? How does fundamentalism remain relevant in a world of evidently breathtaking diversity, an array of different spiritual practices, philosophies, and explorations of the meaning of God and spirit, none of which can seemingly claim to be authoritative? What does fundamentalism evolve into when the children of fundamentalists turn out to be more interested in following Jesus and practicing Christian love than arguing over arcane points of doctrine?